This podcast is a production of DomesticPreparedness.com.
This is Kathy Feynman, editor of DomesticPreparedness.com. I am on the expo floor of the 63rd Annual Conference of the International Association of Emergency Managers in the Paris Hotel in Las Vegas, Nevada, November 2015. Let's talk to some subject matter experts who are here at the conference. Okay, I'm here with Dr. Ron Wakeham from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. And can you tell me one thing that was not discussed at the roundtable that you would like to make sure people know about?
Well, I think one of the things that struck me the most was the talking of the concept that funding or money isn't an issue. Money is always an issue. And let me kind of break that down for you. I've been in places where there was multiple military bases that had a different commander come on board all the time. Multiple fire departments with its own little community within. But also a county board of commissioners who do all the funding. Now, money itself may not be the issue, but hiring the staff to keep up with the changing demographics of a community becomes somewhat difficult.
So emergency management become, at least the way I viewed it in communities, a major department within the city, like public works, the fire, police. As fewer and fewer emergencies happened, the emergency management department was put underneath the fire chief, or the fire chief was made the emergency manager, with not the first concept of what it was about. If it wasn't on fire and the bell didn't ring, they didn't know what to do. And I'm not blaming them. It just wasn't their thing. There was no mitigation, no preparation, unless it had to do with fire. Now, certainly not every case, but most cases, cities and counties no longer have a emergency manager. They have a fire chief / emergency manager's public work director, which to me is change the whole focus on how we have to be ready and the whole community concept. It's we will give them as little money as possible to make that part happen.
Okay, I'm with Bud Marshall, the Southern Nevada Regional Supervisor from Nevada Department of Public Safety. And can you tell me how communities can address all the unique needs within them?
Communities are just like a family unit. Each family is comprised of parents or a number of children if you have more than one child. But as a family unit, they grow, they learn, they move, they do things together. Conversely, each individual member of the family is unique. Some have strengths and weaknesses. Some have some particular needs, special needs, whatever the case may be. And you treat them accordingly, and you grow them and nurture them as individuals, but as part of a family. So as those children grow into teenage years, into adulthood, and have their own families, they're perpetuating that concept of family unit and the uniquenesses of each individual. Conversely, for a state like us, we have a number of children called counties and cities and tribes that we work with. And we find out what their needs are, we nurture those needs, fill those needs, and that's how we try to perpetuate that whole community concept. Whether it be community at the local level, tribal level, or the county level, or even at the state level. It also applies to large urbanized cities where sometimes it's hard and sometimes difficult to create that uniqueness or that I belong to. Say, for example, I grew up in Chicago, but I grew up in a neighborhood, the South Side, so I associated with the South Side as my neighborhood. That's my individuality of being a part of a Chicagoan. But it still applies to the city as a whole. You hear people, well, I root for our sports team, or I root for some local university, or I root for something about the city. There's neighbors, and those neighborhoods are important just as they are part of a family unit. They're part of that family called the city.
Okay, I'm here with Robbie Mobley, the exercise manager at Leidos. Can you tell me what in the training field is missing for building a whole community approach? Okay. Well, first of all, you know, I am the exercise manager at the CDP down in Anniston. So seeing the cohorts that come in for the type of training that we provide, which is all hazard and Seaburney, and getting in all of those people, not necessarily from the same city or the same county, but from the same region, ones that know about each other but don't really understand the different resources and the capabilities that are being brought to the table. So the type of training that we do allows them to do the hands-on, realistic, moving resources around, requesting resources, things like that, in that whole community setting. So to me, that's very beneficial to them.
So is there anything that other communities could be doing better outside of the training facilities to build that kind of relationship?
Well, you know, I think it starts at home. You've got to get to know your neighbors, first of all. And I think we spoke about, you know, interconnectivity between the different groups, whether it be religious, whether it be the VOADs, whatever, building that base foundation initially, everyone getting to know each other, everyone knowing what the different agencies are responsible for. To me, preparedness, because of my background, I think it comes with a price, and it's not always monetary. It's a price. It could just be time. You know, volunteerism is very important when in times of disasters. So, you know, getting to know who's around you and the capabilities that are there that you can draw from prior to a disaster or an emergency is where it's all got to start.
I'm here with Yuri Graves, the Emergency Management Officer for the City of Henderson, Nevada. Can you tell me what you think is missing for the future of whole community preparedness?
Well, for me, when I look at whole community preparedness, I think that it starts with individual and family preparedness. In order to take that next step and to involve all the stakeholders in the community, you have to have that basis of awareness by the general public. They have to recognize the hazards that they face and to know how to take different actions, to mitigate their risk from those hazards. And I think really it begins with the children. I would really like to see a primary focus on, late elementary school, middle school students, and have them focus on emergency preparedness aspects, whether it's, building a home emergency supply kit, developing a family plan, or knowing how to stay informed during an emergency. But I think it really starts with the children. Being a parent, there's probably no better motivation for family readiness than to have your child ask you, hey, are we prepared for an emergency? Or ask their grandparents, are you prepared for an emergency when I'm visiting here? I mean, I think it's the ultimate motivator, and it's definitely the basis for what we try to do in Henderson.
I'm with Dr. Christine Springer, Director of the Executive Master's Degree in Emergency and Crisis Management at University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Can you tell me what you think is the next thing going forward in the whole community approach?
I think it's building a whole community by engaging all of the community, including the minority aspects of it that sometimes get ignored. And when you do that, and my experience has been in doing that in the past for 15 years, often those people become the leaders of building and continuing to build community resilience. So that's really important, and to recognize some of them who will be leaders in doing that is also important, because sometimes we are not the leaders, they are.
I'm Joe Leonard. I'm a senior consultant with the Center for Toxicology and Environmental Health. I recently retired as a commander with the United States Coast Guard. The biggest thing I think that's missing from whole community response and preparedness is, while we talk whole community, we still operate in our own silos, the federal silo, state silo, tribal silo, which is probably the most unusual of them because everyone seems to forget about them, the private sector silo, which is the biggest silo, and they're not always invited into things. We need to do a much better job of breaking those barriers down and getting everyone to communicate, to share training, share exercise, exercises and work together. We always have to do it during a response, but if we could do it before we actually have something that we have to respond to, we're going to get along better, we're going to respond better, it'll be done at a lot less money, there'll be a lot more confidence and trust in one another. And it can be done. I've seen it done in Houston. It can be done.
Kim, with Don Gerken, Lieutenant with Baltimore Police Department and the Office of Emergency Management in Baltimore. Don, can you tell me what is your biggest key takeaway when it comes to whole community?
I think one of the biggest takeaways that I took yesterday was at the end when Bruce Lockwood made the comment about how preparedness spans all the core capabilities, but we do an awful job of measuring it on the local or granular level to see how effective we are in making sure that our communities are prepared.
Okay, Jim Metzger is the Deputy Chief of Emergency Management and Corporate Security for Amtrak. Jim, can you tell me what you think is the most critical part of the whole community approach?
Certainly. So at Amtrak, we go through a variety of communities throughout the country. We have over 500 stations throughout the contiguous 46 states. We typically don't go through Wyoming and South Dakota. But in those areas, we touch on every socioeconomic area from New York City, which is the largest passenger train terminal in North America. With well over thousands of trains a day going through there between MTA, Amtrak, PATH, New Jersey Transit. And then you go out to a smaller community, say Minot, North Dakota, which might see two trains, one going east and one going west in a day. And how do we prepare and serve those communities to our best ability is always a challenge. We run over 2,100 linear miles for Amtrak, and that's a challenge for us, is to understand what does that community's needs and how do we ensure that our customers are being provided for in the best manner throughout the country.
Okay, I'm with Sean Scott, the author of The Red Guide to Recovery. Scott, can you tell me from the personal, individual, family perspective, what is not being covered in the whole community aspect?
Well, I would say that the main weakness is the lack of ability to prepare for recovery in advance. A lot of people think that preparedness is, you know, the three-day kit, and that's all they need. And so there's, you know, when the first responders leave the scene of a disaster, you know, you're on your own. And from a whole community perspective, whether you're an Indian tribe or Spanish-speaking community, elderly, you know, it doesn't matter what facet of the community you're a part of, you're all equal when it comes to recovery. And that is the main key of knowing what to do, what not to do, so that you don't evolve from a survivor into a victim.
Is there anything on the recovery side that you would like to point out that really needs to be changed going forward?
Well, I think the main issue with recovery is understanding what happens once those first responders leave the scene. Who shows up? You know, you have a lot of predators who are looking to prey on the vulnerable, the elderly, the low-income families, because they know that there's a large pool of insurance proceeds sitting there and they want a piece of it. So one key is, you know, letting people know, raising awareness of not to sign contracts prematurely. You know, people just need to understand that they will be targeted for the first couple of weeks after a disaster, and if they don't know what to do or who to trust or where to turn, they are setting themselves up to be victims before the disaster is even hit.
Rich Cirino, distinguished visiting fellow, Harvard University National Preparedness Leadership Initiative, and former deputy administrator of FEMA.
So can you tell me what do you think is the most important thing now with whole community, and where do we need to go from here?
Well, I think one of the most important things is that we're still having a conversation about whole community 5 years later from when the initial one was drafted and put out. And I think one of the most important parts is looking at who is part of the whole community now and how much we have to really look to truly expand that, to look at who is not really that we deal with on a regular basis. Right now we're used to dealing with the private sector, mainly the retail companies, Walmart, Home Depot, Target, etc. But really, we have to now stretch out really much past that when we're talking other private sector. We have to bring in financial institutions. We really have to look at real estate institutions. We have to look at people that can provide housing. So a much broader area we have to look at in the private sector. And then also when we start looking at other groups, we work closely with all the VOADs and the local VOADs and the national voluntary organizations active in disaster. But now, how do we reach out to the non-traditional groups that perhaps we haven't brought in? We did a little bit of that during Sandy, but now how do we look at all those non-traditional groups, and how do we look at technology and how that's going to go in the future? And so I think we really have to start reshaping what we systematically have called whole community over the past few years and how we're going to expand that going forward. I think we also have to start looking at, you know, people start talking decision makers, and, you know, people historically talk within emergency management and public safety and people who are sitting at the table. But really the decision makers with new technology are going to be much broader. It's going to be the public themselves who's the most important part of the whole community, and how the public can actually give them more information in times of crisis, because people are going to have access to it. It's like 85% of the population has a smartphone. So how do we start looking at communicating to people that way, and not just pumping out information, but listening to them, taking that data, analyzing it, and then taking all that large amounts of data from all the different sources and putting out useful information so they can make very good decisions in times of crisis.
Okay, and the efforts you're doing with FEMA Corps, how can you tell me a little bit more about how that fits into the whole community?
FEMA Corps is a great opportunity for young people, 18 to 24-year-olds, to come and do a year of service to the country. But what they also do with that year of service is they're actually in the community all throughout the country, and they epitomize how to bring the whole community together, because you have young people who are out there literally knocking on people's doors, working with them at shelters, working them at the scene of a disaster. And then what we're finding is a lot of the FEMA Corps members, once they finish their year of service, may try to do a second year of service, or even if they go back to school, they actually now have really understanding of how emergency management works from a ground level. And some go into emergency management within FEMA and other cities and towns. But the people who don't even go into emergency management, they are part of the community now that really understands how they can help people. So having people in the community who work there helping people, and they have that for the rest of their lives. So you're really taking 18 to 24-year-olds and giving them the skill they'll have for the rest of their life, and they will be in the community to really help formulate a resilient community.